Anti-vaxxers are still spreading false claims as people die of measles. There you go. It's all your fault. There's the headline. What is the truth behind that headline? Now it's measles, measles, measles all over the world. That mandates are being forced through based upon this disease, measles, this killer disease. Let's look at the history of this. I've studied measles since 1990. I'm not preoccupied with measles as a cause of autism. It's a fascinating virus, particularly as a prototypic live viral vaccine. But as I learn more, I started off in the UK looking at MMR. In fact, measles in the context of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's and colitis, but latterly MMR in the context of autism, because MMR was given in isolation, and mothers were able to say, they were able to pinpoint exactly what happened to their child. It wasn't given with other vaccines, so they could say, this is what happened to my child. I came to testify before Congress in 2000, and I learned about mercury, but I thought, no, nobody would ever, ever put mercury into a child, let alone their worst enemy, but I was, of course, wrong. And then I learned about aluminum, and then I learned about all the excipients and the adventitious viruses and DNA and etc., and it just went on and on and on. So I'm not wedded to measles or MMR as a cause of autism exclusively, although I do believe it's a very important factor. But I studied measles because it teaches us so much about what has happened over time, about immunology, about vaccinology. And so I'm going to use it as a template, not least of which is because the politicians, the vaccinologists, and the pro-vaccine lobby make this their flavor of the month. And with this, they want to force vaccination against a multitude of different infectious agents, not just measles. So, where did it start? It starts really in terms of a perception and understanding. This is Louis Pasteur, who was the founding father of modern vaccinology. And this was the perception at the time. And it comes down to perception. How do we perceive our relationship with the microbe, with the infectious agent? And this has changed dramatically over the last 100 years. This is what he said. If it is a terrifying thought that life is at the mercy of the multiplication of these minute bodies, it is a consoling hope that science will not always remain powerless before such enemies. Enemies. So, in those days, infection, microbes were perceived as the enemy. And indeed, that was a reasonable perception because things like neurosyphilis were major killers. Neurosyphilis was called the great pox. Syphilis was the great pox. Smallpox was smallpox. It was a major, major killer. Antibiotics transformed that disorder. Battlefield gangrene, rheumatic fever, all of these conditions. So infection was not unreasonably perceived at the time. Microbes were perceived as the enemy. We now know, of course, in the modern era of the microbiome, that we are, in fact, 9/10 bacteria, 1/10 human. That we depend for our very survival and have done for a very long time upon microbes. Indeed, the ability of single-celled organisms to develop into what are now complex, multicellular, multi-organ humans and other mammals are dependent upon bacteria getting into cells and becoming mitochondria and providing an energy source that allowed multicellular organisms to exist on this planet. So when did this era start? This St. Mary's Hospital, my old alma mater, September the 3rd, my birthday, there's something uncanny about all of this. Dr. Alexander Fleming, as he was at the time before he was knighted, returned from his vacation to observe that there was a mold growing in some of the colonies that he had in petri dishes of Staphylococcus. And Pasteur said that in the fields of observation, chance favours only the prepared mind. And it was the prepared mind of Alexander Fleming that picked up the observation that his mold juice was capable of killing a number of different bacteria, not simply Staphylococcus. And this laboratory observation was then translated by Florian Chain at Oxford University into the production, the commercial production of penicillin. And this, in the 1940s, antibiotics were the turning point in what was again perceived to be the war on infectious disease. I say the outcomes of diseases like syphilis, battlefield gangrene, scarlet fever were completely rewritten by antibiotics. And so the rhetoric was, this was a miracle. This was a medical miracle. This is the best thing that medicine has ever done. Where have we heard that? Of course, we hear it now with vaccines. And every paper, it's very, very interesting, every paper you read that dares to examine the safety of vaccines has to start. There is an obligatory opening statement that vaccines are the most wonderful thing that medicine has ever done. That's not science. That's not objective. That's simply an opinion. With antibiotics, in 80 years, the miracle turned into something completely different. It turned into what is now a disaster. Bacterial resistance, principally due to suboptimal efficacy and microbial evolution, has completely changed things. So man, in his hubris, in his arrogance, believed that his science could outwit the collective intelligence of microorganisms. These things are exquisitely intelligent. They have a collective intelligence that will mean that they have this ability to adapt, to change, to mutate, but above all, to survive. The evolutionary imperative is that they will survive. So if you give an antibiotic that kills 95% of the bacteria but allows 5% to live, it has a suboptimal efficacy, then what you will have is the emergence of resistant strains. And the next antibiotic will kill 4% of those, 95% of those, but you will still have those strains that evolve and become highly, highly dangerous. And that is what they refer to. The public health officials, not us, not me, public health officials refer to this now as the era of the antibiotic apocalypse. And the evolutionary selection pressures that drove the development and such resistance has generated more dangerous pathogenic strains. So what happens now is that the pharmaceutical industry say, we are not going to invest any further money in the production of new antibiotics. Why? Because they have already achieved resistance to our new antibiotic by the time we get it on the market. So people, you're on your own. And now hospital wards, hospital floors, operating theatres, hospitals themselves are having to be closed because of these highly pathogenic, multi-resistant bacteria that we, in our arrogance, and I say we with a capital W, I mean principally the pharmaceutical industry, I mean the medical profession, have allowed to occur. And the quote from the public health authorities is, the antibiotic apocalypse may already be upon us, with an estimated 50,000 people dying every year in Europe and the US for infections that antibiotics have lost the power to treat. The projected figures are much, much worse. So this is a lesson in the history of man's war on infectious disease. The end of modern medicine. That is how this is described. Are vaccines destined for a similar fate? Why not? Why not? Resurgence of whooping cough, for example, may owe to vaccines' inability to prevent infections. We now have whooping cough pertussis bacteria that is resistant to the immunity produced by the vaccine against its toxin. And this is one of the experts. This is the expert opinion. Pertussis is back because we didn't completely understand how our immune defenses against whooping cough worked. We layered assumptions upon assumptions and now find ourselves in the uncomfortable position of admitting that we may have made some crucial errors. Are we responsible? Are anti-vaxxers to blame? One original prediction was correct, and I will come to that in a moment. But there were certain predictions made in 1961 at a meeting of the National Institutes of Health where they first discussed mass measles vaccination. And I'll come to those in a minute, but I just want to interject with this small thing that I actually put in just recently. And that is that in 2015, the prediction was that it would be easy to distinguish between the vaccine strain and the wild-type strains of measles virus. This would happen very, very quickly. A simple laboratory test would become available where we could distinguish between these two. That was one prediction that was actually somewhat correct, although it didn't happen immediately. You'll be aware that in 2015 there was an outbreak of measles at Disneyland, and what that allowed is for Senator Pan to put pressure upon the California legislature that led to the passage of SB 277, and unfortunately the likely passage of SB 276 as a fully intended, always intended follow-up to his original bill. In that year, they had samples of measles virus isolates taken from people who had measles around the country, including that outbreak in Disneyland, and there were 190-odd isolates that they had. And they sequenced those isolates, they chopped them up into their component genomic elements, and they were able to say whether they were vaccine strain or natural measles. And some 38% of those cases, diagnosed cases of measles, were found to be caused by the vaccine itself. But they didn't say anything. They said nothing at all. They said nothing at all until about a month ago when this came out as a mention in another paper. During the measles outbreak in California in 2015, a large number of suspected cases occurred in recent vaccinees. Of the 194 measles cases sequences obtained in the United States in 2015, 73 were identified as vaccine sequences, unpublished data. Why did they not publish that? I'll tell you why. Because they could never have passed SB 277 if they had. If they'd gone to the legislature in California and said, we want to mandate vaccination across the board for all children or no school, private or public. Oh, but by the way, approaching half the cases were caused by the vaccine. Then they would have been laughed out of court. And so they didn't tell anyone. And so the politicians were deceived, the doctors were deceived, the public were deceived, everybody was deceived. They would never have passed that bill if the truth had been known. Not only are we facing people getting the disease as a cause caused by the vaccine itself, but we are facing vaccine failure. And the entire point of this lecture is it's not failure to vaccinate, it's vaccine failure that is the problem. Let me move on. A measles outbreak occurred in New York City. All cases had prior evidence of measles immunity. Symptoms were consistent with measles. The person who caused this had multiple vaccines. The index patient, that is the patient who started the infection of others in New York, had two doses of measles containing vaccines, and four secondary cases were confirmed who had two doses of measles containing vaccines or measles antibodies. So why did those measles antibodies not protect? We will come to that. So there are two elements to this problem. One is that measles vaccine is itself causing measles, and the second is that measles vaccine is not producing immunity that protects either against natural measles or the vaccine-induced measles. Now, vaccine failure is not simply an inconvenience. It makes vaccines more dangerous. A very good example is mumps. Mumps was a trivial disease in children. It is not a trivial disease, as you know, in post-pubertal males in particular. It can lead to testicular inflammation and infertility. Of course, there is an epidemic of infertility. Are the two linked? We don't know. If you have a vaccine that does not work, there is primary failure because the vaccine doesn't cause you to become immune when you're exposed to it, or secondary failure, that immunity wears off very quickly, or tertiary failure that no one wants to talk about, and that is where you use subsequent generations of the original virus in the laboratory to produce the next generation of vaccines. And over time, that virus is not the original one that they isolated years ago. It's mutated and mutated and mutated, and it's no longer producing a vaccine that's protective. And that's a nightmare. So primary, secondary, and tertiary vaccine failure. Then what you do is you give people temporary immunity or none at all, and then they are susceptible to mumps when it is a more dangerous disease. You merely put off the problem. And so mumps vaccination has made mumps a more dangerous disease. It's not simply that it's an inconvenience because it doesn't work. It is actually producing a more dangerous disease. So we need to understand man's relationship to measles and how that has co-evolved. Fatal measles cases highlight the importance of herd immunity. So I just want to dwell on this notion of herd immunity. It's used, Pans translated it with the help of Paul Offit and others into community immunity. What an irritating thing that is. I have to kind of take a deep breath when I say community immunity. But the notion of what herd immunity really is, and I want to talk about that now. Before vaccination, there was natural herd immunity. This is an extremely important division into the pre-vaccine era, natural herd immunity, and the vaccine era, this quasi-herd immunity that is now talked of. So, natural herd immunity in the pre-vaccine era. This clearly did not operate to prevent measles infection. Indeed, what it did, natural herd immunity at the population level, acted to permit infection, to encourage measles infection at a time when it was least dangerous. So measles is most dangerous to infants under the age of one, presumably, intuitively, because their immune system has yet to develop fully, and adults. So what happened is that natural herd immunity operated to constrain the age of measles to childhood, when it was an increasingly trivial disease. And that led to an extraordinary effect. And that was this. And you've seen this graph, but if you take nothing else away from this talk, this is the most extraordinary example of natural herd immunity in operation. This is from the UK, but I could show you this same graph from any developed country that collected measles data over a protracted period. But you can see that in 1920, measles was a major killer of children during epidemics. 1,200 per million children dying during epidemics. And then there was this extraordinary, this precipitous fall in case fatality rate to the point where by the time the single measles vaccine had been introduced, there had been a 99.96% reduction in case fatality. Now, people will say, well, that's just mortality. What about the disease itself? Mortality is the worst end of the severity of morbidity, the experiencing of the disease itself. So this is a very good proxy for measles getting milder and milder and milder. Death is just the worst outcome. So measles was becoming a dramatically milder disease. Now, the first question you might ask is, well, what would have happened if we'd never intervened with vaccination? Looking at this graph, clearly it would have continued to approach zero. There would have been no mortality at all. Measles would be an extremely mild disease. But, of course, we can't say what happened would have happened because we intervened. And all the benefit of this is ascribed to vaccination, when that is totally inappropriate. So one of the questions is why? Why did we see this extraordinary fall in case fatality rate? And there are two key elements to herd immunity. And I don't want to talk about nutrition. I don't want to talk about improved standard of living. I can get into that and talk about that for a long time. But I want to dwell upon two key elements. And that is that a single exposure to natural measles led to lifelong immunity. And this came from an observation by a doctor called Parnham, who went to the Faroe Islands. And island populations, the Faroes are north of Scotland, they're owned by Denmark. And the thing about these discrete, isolated island populations is certainly before the Second World War, they had a unique pattern of epidemics. You had to reintroduce the infection from outside into the population to cause another epidemic, because the population was too small to sustain an endemic level of disease. So these islands experienced epidemics perhaps every 70 years. And what Parnham observed is when he went there and observed a measles epidemic, the only people who didn't get measles were people over 70 who'd been alive during the previous epidemic. And so you had this observation that's since been substantiated, that one exposure to measles led to lifelong protection. The other is passive maternal immunity. And that is the ability of mothers who've been infected with natural measles to confer excellent transplacental and breast milk immunity to their babies to protect them during that first year of life, that critical first year of life. And so these two elements, a single exposure of to measles in childhood leading to lifelong immunity and therefore preventing you getting measles as an adult, and maternal immunity producing excellent protection of babies during the first year of life following natural measles in the mother, protecting babies, and therefore measles was getting a milder disease. And graphically put, this is the kind of thing, this is the frequency, the percentage of cases that these two elements, lifelong protection from a single exposure and passive maternal immunity, constrained the age of exposure to childhood when it was a much safer disease to experience. Some say even a beneficial disease to experience. And the benefit, quite apart from anything, is that one exposure led to lifelong immunity and protection and good maternal immunity. So there are two benefits right off the bat. And that led to this. And this is an extraordinary consequence of natural herd immunity. What an amazing example. Nothing will ever emulate, will ever reproduce this kind of effect. This is what we had. This is where we were going up to the 1960s. One of the questions, a very reasonable question, is would it have been safer just to leave this well alone? Just to let nature take its course? Man was coming into a balance with this infection. It was not a killer disease. And then we come to the vaccine era. And this started with John Enders. John Enders at Harvard, he isolated the measles virus for the first time from an individual called David Edmonston. And this is the origin of the Edmonston vaccine strain virus from which all currently used measles vaccine viruses were derived. The vaccine strain, the Edmonston B strain, interestingly, was withdrawn. It was highly reactive. It was dangerous. But it wasn't too dangerous once it had been taken off the shelves in the United States of America to take down and expose the Yanomami tribe in the Orinoco Basin to as an experiment, a natural experiment, looking at a virgin soil population, a population that had never experienced measles before in its entire history. So the CDC and the American Atomic Energy Commission thought it would be an interesting experiment, not only to inject these people with radioactive materials to compare with them with survivors from Nagasaki, but also to inject them with measles vaccine that had been banned in America because it was dangerous. And thousands were killed by that vaccine experiment. And it was based upon, at the time, the enthusiasm for vaccination based upon the perceived success of polio vaccine, which is another story altogether. It's also interesting that in documents recently released at the end of the Obama administration, is that vaccines were perceived by the Central Intelligence Agency as a wonderful currency for negotiating with developing countries. That if America could be seen to be benevolent by giving people vaccines that protected their children against disease, then they might win favor with those developing countries in respect of security issues. So this became a political weapon. America also wanted to remain at the forefront of bioterrorism warfare, of biowarfare. And so the CIA were heavily involved in influencing American vaccination policy back in the 60s and up until today. And therefore, there could be no bad news about vaccines. This was part of America's currency for dealing with the rest of the world. And there was competition because the Russians were developing at that time what was called the Leningrad 4 strain of measles virus. So they were in trial already. So there was huge competition. And people liken this to the missile gap, a missile gap that had to be closed. We had the vaccine gap. And this is a story that is being told and will be told by Patrick Tierney, a wonderful medical historian. And so there was a meeting at the National Institutes of Health in 1961. The topic was universal measles vaccination. John F. Kennedy was encouraged to write to this meeting describing measles as a formidable and widespread threat. He was a wonderful president, but I'm afraid presidents are very vulnerable when it comes to medical issues, particularly contagion, infectious agents, because it is not their field of expertise. Was it a formidable and widespread threat? Sir Graham Wilson, who was the world's leading microbiologist, was invited from the UK to address that meeting. And he said this: measles is one of the inevitable but relatively unimportant maladies of childhood. In England, and I dare say the US, one in 100,000 dies, and in Scandinavia, this is one in a million. So Scandinavia had effectively achieved universal infection with eradication of death from measles. And he said, the real burden of measles, what is it? And what is it about the child who dies that merits further study? So rather than focus upon mass vaccination, should we not ask the question, what is different about that child? And therefore, should we not focus our attention on that child rather than have a blanket policy really about which we know nothing at all? And not to understand that, not to do further study, would be unethical. And, of course, those further studies were never done. Enders, the man who'd actually isolated the virus itself, also said, a measles vaccine is desirable only if it confers immunity comparable to that afforded by the natural disease. So he was extremely cautious. But the vaccinologists, of course, won the day. And they won the day with certain promises, certainties. Absolute certainties, and this is the greatest danger of all. They were so certain, by their own admission, their own rightness, that they understood they could have dominion over measles. They could mutate it in the laboratory. They could give it by a different route, different strain, different age, and they would control measles. And the virus lasts. They said that there would be protection of all children from a single shot of this vaccine, that like natural immunity, it would be lifelong. There would be no permanent brain damage, injury, or death. Measles would be certainly and rapidly eradicated using this vaccine. The vaccine virus could not be shed from the vaccinated to the unvaccinated, and there would be no need for mandatory vaccination. Which of these promises have been kept? Not a single one. Not a single one. So do we have any reason to trust the assertions, the certainty, the promises made by these people? No. None whatsoever. So the early observations after vaccination is that in the 70s and 80s, there were outbreaks of measles in school-aged children. in age-appropriate children, children in whom the disease was mild. And this accounted for the majority, and Wood and Bunnell have described this, but even amongst that group, 42% had been vaccinated against measles itself. And you see this dramatic fall in the number of reported cases of measles, and this is in the US in blue and in Mexico in green. And then you see this honeymoon period where measles appears to be very low in terms of the number of reported cases, and then there is this resurgence after that honeymoon period. And it's that resurgence that is now of great interest. So, beyond that, in 1989, there were 170 outbreaks in the US, and that was up from 40 to 50 per year. And this increased through the 1990s. Now the majority of children who were getting hit were school-age and college-age students. In other words, we saw the beginnings of a displacement in the age of infection. It had gone from childhood now into college-age children. And 80% of these were appropriately vaccinated. Another example from Texas, despite the children having a 95.8% vaccine immunity to measles, there was a prolific outbreak in those two schools, and they concluded that epidemics of measles can be sustained in school-age populations despite very high vaccination rates. The vaccine was not working. One of those original promises that it would produce immunity in all children was wrong, and it certainly wasn't going to produce immunity for life. Later, there was an 89-91 epidemic, and now we had a different pattern of disease. There was a dramatic shift from older children to preschool children, to younger children, and it was highest in children under one. And this then became dangerous. This then became dangerous because what we didn't know at the time is that mothers who'd had vaccination did not give good immunity to their babies at all. So babies under one were now vulnerable to measles, and that is when mortality was going to be greatest. So what we saw is exactly that. Death rates were highest in the younger children. And this is now happening all over the world. This is a paper from Eastern Europe where the vaccine was available since 1964. There's now been, after that honeymoon period, a resurgence of measles, which is entirely predictable. Most affected are under one or 13 to 24 and are recipients of two doses of the vaccine. Bear in mind, the mean age of measles during the period of natural measles infection was 4 to 5 years of age. So there's been this dramatic displacement in age of infection. So there is an accumulating number of susceptible people over time. We are becoming, as a population around the world, more and more vulnerable to measles. Herd immunity and vaccination. Vaccination has destroyed natural herd immunity. This is the important thing. Politicians need to understand that. This displacement in the age of measles to when it is more dangerous has come about precisely because of vaccination. It's not your fault. It's a very, very misguided policy that assumed knowledge of this infectious agent, which was totally inappropriate. Single exposure leading to lifelong immunity has gone. Passive immunity, this paper from France describes the dramatic reduction in passive immunity in mothers there. It's gone. Vaccination has made measles a more dangerous disease. And then we see this. Measles strikes back. It's the kind of paper we're going to be seeing time and again. This just happens to come from the Far East. Do boosters work? So the policy is, okay, well, let's just give more. Let's just give more. We have this remarkable situation, this irony, where you have a product which is a dramatic, a remarkable commercial success in terms of volume of sales, precisely because it doesn't work. What happened to the free market? What other product sells because it's useless? It's bizarre. But that's all they've got. That's all they've got, is give a booster, give a booster, give a booster. Let's look at this in Finland, in 1989, there was an explosive outbreak of measles in a rural principality in Finland, 51 cases. High school students had had 1 to 3 doses of the vaccine, and those infected at home, and those infected at home where they're exposed to the coughing of the person with measles all night long, all day long, they get a very high dose of exposure. And if they share a bedroom or a bed, they get an even higher dose of exposure. And what happened, what they found, is the higher the intensity of exposure by virtue of whether you shared a room, you got infected at home, whether you shared a bedroom, then it broke through that barrier of vaccine-induced immunity. Whether you'd had 3 vaccines, it didn't make any difference, you got measles. So when siblings shared a bedroom, where they were going to get a very high intensity of exposure, they slept together and they were coughing over each other all night long, they got a massive dose of viral exposure, then there was a 78% risk of measles observed in those who had been multiply vaccinated. And here's a really interesting story right now. Now, I didn't realize this, but this comes from a blood transfusion unit, a group down in Boca. And what they were doing is, they were preparing intravenous immunoglobulin to give to people with primary immunodeficiency who needed protection against measles. And what they found is that over the years, their donors could no longer give them blood samples from which they could extract IVIG that had antibody against measles. This vaccinated population no longer met the FDA requirements for neutralizing antibody against measles virus. So they couldn't use them. They had nothing to give these people with primary immunodeficiency in the face of vaccination. Now, bear in mind, what we're told about is the immunodeficient. So here's another irony. So what they did is they said, okay, let's give them a booster vaccine before we take their blood and see if we can boost their level of neutralizing antibody, isolate it and extract it, and then meet FDA requirements. And they didn't. They didn't come close. What it led to was a doubling of the neutralizing antibody titer, the key protective antibody titer, but that wasn't anywhere near enough. And in a very short time, 100 and odd days, all of that antibody had disappeared back to baseline. That would mean that you would have to have 3+ doses of measles vaccine per year for life to protect you against measles. So I would buy stock in Merck if I were you. That's a surefire winner. But the problem is there are diminishing returns, and every time you do it, it gets lower and lower and lower and lower. It's an absolute, complete, and utter failure. So, let me just show you a graph which is really concerning. This is a graph of successive birth cohorts. So people born in 1930s right up to people born in the 1990s. And it looks at the level of neutralizing antibody in the blood of those individuals. And before, you see the dotted lines, the vertical dotted lines, the first one when the single vaccine came in, the second one when the booster dose came in, and you see the neutralizing antibody titers in those groups of people of different ages. And what you see is that those who got natural measles had very, very high levels of protective antibody. And this has dropped to nothing. Despite booster vaccination, we now have a population who are no longer protected against this virus. And that is terrifying, because now what happens is we become the Yanomami. We become that virgin soil population who are vulnerable, very vulnerable to measles. Should we fear it? Should we fear measles? Absolutely. Why? Because of what we have done. Not the natural infection, but what man has done in his desire to exert dominion and to profit from this agent. So, we've talked about primary, secondary vaccine failure. These are things that are not discussed. What is discussed is people like you who may have hesitancy about vaccinating. It's the anti-vaxxers. That's all they've got left to blame. But they know the truth. The smart ones, know the truth. And they know we are in a parlous situation. Sooner or later, we must all sit down to a feast of consequences. One interesting observation is that we've encouraged this in the way we produce the vaccine itself. So with natural measles, you develop this balance between humoral immunity, the production of antibody, which protects you from extracellular virus. The virus that's floating around in the blood when you initially get infected, antibodies will protect. They will bind to that and they will neutralize it. But you also need cellular immunity because the virus gets into cells and that's where it reproduces before it is again released into the blood. So you need these two things set up at the same time that produce lifelong immunity. But the way that we produce, now the rash of measles, it's not a side effect. What it is the beginning of healing from measles. It's the cellular immune response killing virally infected cells. So the rash is a marker of the beginning of healing from measles. But the way you produce the vaccine is you look at blood from people who've been exposed to various strains of the virus and you say, they've got the highest antibodies, that's what we want. So you are biasing it towards this side of the immune response, what's called the Th2 immune response. And what that does is produce an imbalance where you have an inadequate induction of the cellular immune response, and that is vital for lifelong immunity. You produce a vaccine which doesn't cause a rash because that's perceived to be an adverse reaction. But that's actually what you want to see. So by virtue of the way in which we make vaccines against measles, we are biasing it towards an excessive antibody response but a deficient cellular immune response, and that isn't adequate. And that's what's been happening, and the problem with this is we know from studies of viruses like hepatitis C, amongst others, is that if you have a defective cellular immune response, then you encourage the evolution of what are called escape mutants of the virus. Mutants of the virus that are no longer susceptible to the immunity produced by the vaccine. That is not a situation you want to encourage. Measles isn't a single thing, either in a natural infection or in a vaccine. It's a swarm of quasi-species that have various differences at the genetic level and behavioral level. There'll be a dominant strain amongst them that becomes, say, the vaccine strain. But there are multiple mutations amongst them. And among that swarm, there may be a virus, a quasi-species, that is capable not only of eluding the immunity from the vaccine, but producing a very severe disease. And the fact that measles is infecting and spreading among those with vaccine-induced immunity means that this wall must have been breached already. I talked about the Yanomami, and there they are, escape mutants in a virgin soil population, an escape mutant that eludes the immune response to a vaccine in a population with no effective immunity behaves like a virgin soil population. So are we sitting on a time bomb? That is the question. Are we sitting on a situation that is similar but far worse to the situation with antibiotics? Antibiotics were given to a discrete population who had an infection, maybe. Antibiotics, vaccines are given to everyone. Are the fears merited? Measles has, throughout its history, been stable. There has been no obvious genetic selection pressure on this virus to change it dramatically. It's what's known as a monotypic virus. What does that mean? Of the 8 major groups of measles virus, if I get one infection from one group, I will develop an immune response that will protect me from all other groups. That doesn't happen with every infection, but measles is like that. That makes it monotypic. I get clade B and I'm protected against D. That's the way it was, but not anymore. And this paper came out just a few days ago. And I just want to say that I've predicted very few things in my life, apart from two, perhaps, recently that have come true. One is that Arya Stark killed the Night King. You can always tell how many people watch Game of Thrones when I say that. Come on, people, you don't watch Game of Thrones. You don't have time to watch Game of Thrones. Will you? I made that call. I was very pleased with myself. And the second was that we would generate escape mutants of measles virus under the genetic selection pressure of vaccination, and then we have a real problem. We will generate strains of measles virus that are no longer susceptible to the immunity induced by the vaccines. We have no immunity. We are a virgin soil population. And that's just happened. This is a paper that was just published. Antigenic drift defines a new D4 subgenotype of measles virus. And this was interesting, this subgenotype, this mutant that was not susceptible to the immunity produced by the vaccine was found in the UK and France, where they'd been using intensive measles vaccination for a prolonged period and therefore had put genetic selection pressure on the virus, but not in East Africa, where it was relatively sporadic and relatively recently introduced. And this virus, this new virus, this quasi-species, was not neutralized by pooled serum taken from US blood donors. So the US has no protection against this D4 strain of measles virus. So waiting in the wings is an old adversary, perhaps, taking on a different guise. And while we play out this game of who's to blame, of herd immunity and community immunity, of profits and loss, of risk and benefit, then this new agent sits there waiting. Waiting for what? Now, in summary, universal measles vaccination was founded on a set of false premises and promises that have resulted in the destruction of natural herd immunity, a hazardous shift in age of susceptibility, atypical and highly transmissible measles in vaccinees, because the measles they get isn't obvious. It's not as clinically obvious as natural measles, so you can go out into the population and spread it more widely before you are designated as a measles case and quarantined. That we have the emergence of resistant strains in a world of acquired immune virginity and complex and severe adverse reactions. And all they have is the band-aid of booster doses on a gangrenous limb to protect us. Now, a very good friend of mine, someone I'm very fond of, said, you've got to really end this story on a high note. You can't send people away with this notion that it's all over. But, you know, there was a wonderful series on television. It's called Our Planet. Is it on National Geographic? It's on one of those wonderful channels, and it's fabulous. And it's with David Attenborough as the narrator. And he talks about the destruction of planet Earth in various aspects, in the Arctic, in the oceans, in the coastal waters, in the rivers. But he always ends by saying, what is remarkable? What is remarkable is if you allow nature to do it, nature will heal. And it will heal very, very quickly, remarkably quickly, more quickly than we could ever imagine if we allow it to happen. And so we need to, one, pay a great deal more respect to these infectious agents. They are far more complex than we've ever imagined. And in doing so, we need to let nature define what happens. And we need to let nature also define what happens in the healing of the body from these insults. The body has an extraordinary ability to heal itself, not just to heal the planet or this ecological disruption that's been created, but to heal itself if we allow it, if we give it the tools to do so. So the message that we need to take forward in our quest for health freedom in this country, and everything that goes with that, is that if we act appropriately and promptly and deal with this, then we will allow nature to restore a balance. We may go through a very uncomfortable period in the interim, but I believe, ultimately, that we are going to have to allow nature to take its course in order to restore the integrity of man's relationship with the microbe. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.